Let's pick up where we left off in the book of Hebrews, chapter 7. As you recall, the book of Hebrews is written by basically an unknown author, but I personally believe it was the Apostle Paul, just because it seems to have his signature all over in terms of his style of writing, his insights and his observations and his doctrines, everything that he puts forth. In my opinion, Hebrews is probably one of the deepest books and the most profound books you'd read in the New Testament. I mean, it's just one of those things that just has tremendous spiritual insight. And it's just, the author constantly goes back and forth from the Old Testament to the New to demonstrate to us exactly who Jesus Christ is as far as his person, as far as him being the Son of God, as far as him being divine, as far as him being eternal. But it also stresses very, very clearly Jesus Christ's role as a priest, a high priest, a priest who is the one who is our priest forever, as the scriptures proclaim. He is our priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. And this is what we're getting into, kind of the theme or the meat of these the next several chapters. It deals with this particular individual named Melchizedek. Melchizedek is only mentioned twice in the Old Testament. He was mentioned, I think, in the 14th chapter of Genesis, and he's mentioned in the 110th chapter of Psalms. And yet the writer of Hebrews is able to bring about so much information in regards to this, his, you know, who this individual is as far as his prefigurement of Jesus' role as our priest. Okay? And we read in the last chapter or so that one of the main things about a priest is that a requirement is that he must be selected by God. Okay? Somebody just doesn't choose the office of priesthood. Okay? And nowhere in the Old Testament will you find any particular priest who held the office of king or any particular king who held the office of priest. Okay, the two were very distinct and separate. There was a particular king by the name of Uzziah who tried to usurp the authority of the priest and offer up priestly sacrifice. He went into the temple and God smote him with leprosy. Now, he was a very good priest. I mean, not a very good. He was a very good man and a very good king. But it went to his head. You know, power corrupts, total power corrupts totally. We see it in our own government today. But this guy, you know, got to the point where he just figured, well, you know, I'm king and, you know, I'm a good person or whatever. He just felt like, hey, I can offer sacrifice to God and be acceptable. Well, God struck him with leprosy. There was another king by the name of King Saul, the very first king of Israel, who presumed upon the priesthood. And because of it, he was basically cursed for it, and his kingdom was torn from him and given to David. But the interesting thing about Melchizedek is that there's so little known about him. We don't know. There's no genealogy about him. Okay, we don't know when he was born. We don't know who his parents were. We don't know when he died. We have no information whatsoever. But that in itself is pointed out by the writer of Hebrews, points to the fact that he was a prefigurement of Christ. Some scholars think that, well, Melchizedek was probably an angel or something that came down as a priest. That would be ludicrous. That's ridiculous, because one of the requirements of being a priest is you had to be a man. So Melchizedek was a true man, a real historical figure. He prefigured Christ or prototyped Christ in the sense that he had no beginning and end in terms of us being able to understand where he came from, who was his parents, you know, who was his descendants. We know nothing about him in that regard. So in that regard, he is a prefigurement of Christ. But let's just read this chapter 7 and break it down in terms of what, you know, how Melchizedek prefigured Christ and how Christ, in a sense, now is our priest forever. Not in a sense, he is literally our priest forever. But how the two combine together now in the New Testament, beginning with verse 1 in chapter 7, it says, "For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham as he was returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham appointed a tenth of all of his spoils, was first of all, by the translation of his name, king of righteousness, and then also king of Salem, which is the king of peace." We have no idea how Melchizedek was ordained. All we know is that we are told specifically that he was a priest of the Most High God, and we are told specifically that nobody takes on the position of priesthood by their own doing. In other words, they've got to be appointed. And God obviously appointed this Melchizedek. Now, this is speculative on my part, but I believe what happened was that this Melchizedek was a prominent figure somewhere along the line because he was a king, but God intervened in his life, appeared to him, and ordained him himself, saying that you are going to be my priest. You are going to represent me to men and men to me. In other words, he was divinely ordained. That's all we know about him. Okay, and then it gives us a few insights here saying that he was the king of Salem. Salem is what? Means what?
Peace.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of Bible interpreters seem to indicate Melchizedek was a really Christ himself.
Well, that wouldn't.
I don't know if that.
No.
You know,
it wouldn't be.
Concur with that or not.
No, it wouldn't be. And the reason I say that, and that's why I'm saying other people have made that suggestion.
Yeah.
Okay, and I say that it's not true because it tells us right here that he was a man. If you look at that verse 4, now observe how great this man was whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of their choice spoil. In other words, he was acting as priest. Now, I don't believe that he was the pre-incarnate Christ, okay? Mm-hmm. I believe that he was a man appointed by God, mm-hmm. but, okay, and he was established a unique priesthood, all right? Well, Christ at that particular time was not a man. He did not take on... So, in other words, we are told earlier in Hebrews that you can't be a priest if you're not a man.
Mm-hmm.
No angel can hold the office of priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be a man because you've got, in order to be a priest, you've got to be able to identify with men in their weaknesses, in their families, in their shortcomings, in their faults. Well, we know that Christ has identified with our humanity fully and completely apart from sin. So he is the ideal priest. Okay, that's why I say, no, Melchizedek was not, you know, Christ incarnate, or Christ, the pre-incarnate Christ. Okay, he was not an angel. He was a man. Now, that's speculative on my part, but at the same time, I feel like I need to be dogmatic about it, because it's pretty clear, especially reading a few chapters earlier in Hebrews, that, okay, the office could only be held by somebody who could sympathize with the weaknesses of men. Okay, so look at some of the other things about that. He's king of Salem. Salem is the ancient name for what? What city?
Jerusalem.
Okay, and Salem means peace. So here it is, he prefigures Christ and the fact that Christ is the king of peace, right?
Mm-hmm.
The prince of peace. So this king Melchizedek is the king of Salem, the priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham as he was returning from the slaughter of the kings. Now, if you remember, if you go back into the book of Genesis, you know, I think it's around the 12th, 13th, 14th chapter, we read about how Lot and, you know, a number of the people of Sodom and Gomorrah were captured, and along with a lot of spoil, and they were captured by these four other kings, eastern kings, or whoever they were. They came down and they raided the land, and they took these people hostage along with all the spoils they could carry, and they took off with Abraham's nephew. Well, when Abraham found that out, he got together all of his hired men and as many people as he could get, and he let out after them. And after several days, he caught up with them, and God gave him a tremendous victory over these four kings. Well, remember, coming back from, you know, this war with these kings, he was carrying all the spoils back, and then the king of Sodom and Gomorrah came out and said, well, you know, I'll just take the people back, you can keep all of the spoils. And Abraham would not take any of the spoils because he says, hey, I don't want the king of Sodom saying that he's made Abraham rich. But Abraham did say, well, what you need to do is pay me for all of my expenses, anything that I've, you know, expended in recapturing your people and your spoils and my nephew, okay, the food and his men that he needed to clothe and feed and whatever on this expedition. Well, out of that, that was Abraham's portion of the spoils, just simply to cover his costs. Well, Abraham turned around and he gave this to Melchizedek. Now, a couple things that's pretty profound in what he's saying here is he says that in verse 2, to whom also Abraham appointed a tenth of all the spoils, first of all, by the translation of his name, King of Righteousness, and also the King of Salem, which is the King of Peace. Now, that Melchizedek means righteousness. Some of your Bibles might say justice, right? basically the same thing, but that prefigures Christ to a T. He is the King of justice. He is the King of righteousness. And in verse 3 it says, without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, he abides as a priest perpetually. Now, look at the way it's worded here. Okay, he doesn't have a mother or a father. It doesn't mean that he wasn't a man. He wasn't born. He wasn't begotten. It's just simply that in the Old Testament, especially in the book of Genesis, every person of importance that you will find, you can trace their genealogy. Okay? Not so with Melchizedek. All right? That's what makes him very, very unique. It's this very, very important person who we don't know where he came from. He comes out of the pages of history, and he leaves off the pages of history a total mystery. But it's not the Son of God, because what does it say here? It says, without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God. It doesn't say here, he was the Son of God. He was made like the Son of God in that respect. He was a man, but in this respect that we can't trace his genealogy, he prefigured Christ as having no beginning, no end. Then he says in verse 4, it says, now observe how great this man was, who to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of the choicest spoils. And those indeed of the sons of Levi who received the priest's office have commandment in the law to collect a tenth from the people, that is, from their brethren, although these are the descendants of Abraham. But the one whose genealogy is not traced from them collected a tenth from Abraham and blessed the one who had promises. But without any dispute, the lesser is blessed by the greater. And in this case, mortal men receive tithes, but in that case, one receives them of whom it was witnessed that he lives on. And so to speak, through Abraham, even Levi, who received tithes, pays tithes, for he was still in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. Now, this is very, very deep. It's very profound. But what it's basically saying is Abraham was okay, he's the father of the Jews. Okay? The Aaronic priesthood did not come into existence till over 1,500 years after Abraham died. Okay? But it's saying here that the Levi was actually in the loins of Abraham, okay, in a sense. In other words, the seed of Levi was with Abraham. And Levi would come on the scene some 1,500 years later, and it was through the tribe of Levi that God was going to raise up the Aaronic priesthood. Okay? Here's a couple of interesting things to me. All right, he's saying that in the fact that Abraham bows down to Melchizedek, Melchizedek blesses Abraham, and saying here the greater always blesses the lesser, proving that Melchizedek was greater than Abraham, even though Abraham was the father of the Jews and the most blessed person of the Jews, a matter of fact, of all mankind, in a sense. But he was blessed by this Melchizedek. When Abraham gives Melchizedek a tenth of the tithes, he said it was the same as if Levi was giving it to him. Okay? Because they're all bound up together. We are told in Acts, that we all come from one blood. You look around today, you see the diversity throughout the world as far as people, as far as nations, as far as races, as far as colors, as far as cultures. I mean, it's just an incredible diversity. And of course, ignoramus man, who thinks he's so smart, figures, well, we all came from some primeval slime, right? And you know, the people just popped up out of nowhere all over the place, and then we got all these different races. Well, we all come from one blood. When Adam sinned, we all sinned, right? We all fell into this. Now, here, Abraham is giving tithes to Melchizedek. And in a sense, because they were all tied in together, Levi is now giving, you know, tithes to Melchizedek, showing that Melchizedek is greater. Now, I don't want to get off on a real tangent here, and I don't want to get into horror stories, but I want to bring something up that I think is, you know, it's almost like you can't avoid it nowadays. It's this whole situation of cloning, okay? And in regards to what's happening here, when we're talking about God's divine order of things, how we all come from one blood, and how God has uniquely made each individual person. Well, you know, some of the horror stories that, you know, you read about cloning now, it's just a matter of time before human beings are going to be starting to be cloned, okay? You can take a person's DNA, I don't care if you want to take it out from his toenail or from his, you know, from his navel, whatever, and you reproduce, you know, basically yourself. I mean, some of the potentials. I mean, a woman can give birth to herself. I mean, if you stop and think about some of these things, okay? But here's something that I just feel like is going to bring down the curtain. And it was one of the latest Time magazines, and it says, of headless mice and men. Now, I'm not going to read the whole article, but it's something that we need to consider about where we are going morally with our technology. But it says, during the past 4 years, one group created headless mice, others headless tadpoles. For sheer Frankenstein vantage, the purposeful creation of these animals monsters has no equal. Take the mice. Researchers found that genes that tells the embryo to produce the head, they deleted it. They did this in 1,000 mice embryos, 4 of which were born. I use the term loosely, having no way to breathe, the mice died instantly. In other words, science is able to produce by cloning mice without heads, okay, and tadpoles without heads, okay, but they can't live, obviously, once they're born, there's no way that they can breathe, but they're perfect physically, except for no head. And it says here, why then create them? The Texas researchers wanted to learn how genes determine embryo development, but you don't have to be a genius to see the true utility of manufacturing headless creatures for their organs, fully formed, perfectly useful, ripe for plundering. Why should you be panicked? Because humans are next. It would almost certainly be possible to produce human bodies without forebrain, Princeton biologist Lee Silver told the London Sunday Times. These human bodies without any semblance of consciousness would not be considered persons, and thus it would be perfectly legal to keep them alive for future sources of organs. Alive, quote unquote. Never have a pair of quotation marks loom so ominously. Take the mouse-frog technology, apply it to humans, combine it with cloning, and you become a god. With a single cell taken from, say, your finger, you produce a headless replica of yourself, a mutant twin, arguably lifeless, that because of your own personal, precisely tissue-matched organ form. I'm not going to read it all, but it goes on. It says, it won't be long, however, before these technical barriers are breached and the ethical barriers are already cracking. Lewis Wolpert, professor of biology at the University College of London, finds producing headless humans personally distasteful, but given the shortage of organs, does not think distaste is sufficient reason not to go ahead with something that would save lives. Isn't this the same old argument? So then it just simply goes on. It says, when prominent scientists are prepared to acquiesce in or indeed encourage the deliberate creation of deformed and dying quasi-human forms, you know we are facing a bioethical abyss. Human beings are ends, not a means. There is no grosser corruption of biotechnology than creating a human mutant and disemboweling it for our pleasure or spare parts. I mean, this is where we are headed. And, you know, there's already been this, I guess this genetic engineer who says that he's going to go ahead and clone humans, okay? And it's just a matter of time when we start doing this. But it's like, you know, I don't know where, in other words, everything becomes so, let's say, such a gray area and so confusing as to, Is this thing human? I mean, does it have a soul? Does it have an eternal spirit? You know, we don't know where we've crossed the line because it's no longer we shouldn't do something. It's, hey, if we can do it, let's do it. I mean, that's where we're at. So, I mean, I don't know about these things. I mean, you look at some of our technology and you see where it's all leading us. And I'm just seeing that what is it going to bring about, obviously, is just, you know, more and more judgment. Now, I didn't want to get off on this tangent, okay? But when we're talking about here, Levi being in the loins of Abraham, okay, and how God, and it tells us, it says in the Bible that before God forms us in our mother's wombs, he knows us, mm-hmm. okay? And that he has ordained our days, okay? And, you know, all this has been predetermined by God. And then we step in and we say, well, now we're going to play God. That's what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And we figure, and there's always a justification, isn't there? There's always a justification. The justification is, hey, this can save lives. You realize, well, once we're doing this, I mean, you know, it's almost like, what's left but judgment, okay, when people end up doing this? But there's always, like I said, there's always a justification. But we have to look at things from a biblical perspective, okay, and say, okay, if you look at what he's saying here about Melchizedek, about Abraham, about Levi, okay, about the priesthood, about, you know, just basically the human race and God's design, you see that, hey, we are way, way, way off the mark in terms of God's will when we start dabbling around like this, because we've reduced human beings, okay, to it's nothing more than a commodity. And if it's not profitable, hey, then, like in Nazi Germany and Hitler's reign, it's like, hey, he ended up with a policy that basically said, get rid of all useless leaders. Basically, if you were old, if you were decrepit, if you were mentally, physically, emotionally handicapped, hey, man, do away with you, because you're a drain on the state. The state was everything. Hitler was God, and the state was God. Well, that's what we're getting now. People are playing God, and now they're going to, you know, be God. And we see this coming. I mean, we've heard the old saying, or you've heard the old saying, or I certainly have, about when men refuse to be governed by God, they will be ruled by tyrants. Okay, and we can see what's happening to this world today. We can see it in this country. This is why I get so incensed when I see what's happening in this country. Because we are losing our freedoms one little incremental step at a time. One little step at a time, we are losing our freedoms. Okay, this whole situation about smoking, I don't want to get off on that either, but you know, now they've banned it in bars. Now, hey, I'm not a smoker. I don't appreciate being around smoke. But I just feel like this. You know where the next step is? I guarantee you, if the Lord doesn't return within 5 years, I guarantee within 5 years, they're going to say, okay, no smoking in your homes. And they're going to justify this by saying because it's child abuse if there's children around. And how are they going to monitor that? Well, if they suspect you, I guarantee you they're going to start bugging your homes. And you don't think that, you think this is a little far-fetched? 3 days ago, 4 days ago, 5 days ago, I read in the paper that Germany of all places, has now legalized secretly videotaping people's houses and wiretapping their houses and taping their houses or their homes. They've legalized this now because they have justified this by saying that, hey, organized crime is getting so out of hand that if we suspect a particular home or household of being involved in organized crime, they're going to come in there and secretly set up videotapes and audio tapes. Now, we see where this is headed, right? Look at this country. We are losing our freedoms, little by little, incremental step at a time, because it's a judgment. We will not be governed by God, so we're going to be ruled by tyrants. So this is what we're seeing. More and more and more, we are being suffocated. I cut out some articles here. There was an article even yesterday. It's kind of interesting. We're doing a complete total remodel in our store. And they're now putting in over 13 different cameras in our store. Now, they've justified this by saying that, well, you know, we want to make sure that if somebody says they slipped and they fell and they try to sue the store, that we'll have it on camera. But you know darn well that it's also an infringement upon the employees, because mm-hmm. everybody's going to be watching you.
Oh, yeah.
And now they have, they just installed the phone 2 days ago, a new phone that you can't call out on, okay? But this phone that they have hooked up, if that was the phone, and there was somebody back in the back room want to hear our conversation, all they had to do is flick a switch and they could listen to everything that's being said here, without our knowledge. That's how all these phones are hooked up in our store now. You see, and I thought it was pretty interesting. There was this big article.
It's not a government building or anything.
No. And you know, the interesting thing is there was a big huge here. It is right here. This is just yesterday's article about. Work, no place for privacy. And they even have, in some of these places, they're being sued because they put cameras in restrooms to watch their employees, to watch them.
Well, what, watch them go to the bathroom?
Yeah, yeah. This is where we're headed, okay? Now, what my point is this, okay? If you can't see the connection here with Melchizedek, with Levi, with the connection is this. God has placed an infinite value on people. people are putting absolute no value on people. And they're just nothing more than a commodity. People are losing their intrinsic value because, why? Because we no longer see men, women, children being created in the image and likeness of God. Okay? So this is what's happening to us. It's all judgment. Okay? We are losing our freedom. We got Big Brother all over the place. And it's getting worse and worse and worse. And the groundwork is being laid for the Antichrist. When it comes to power, he's going to have control over everyone. Why? Because those who refuse to be governed by God will be ruled by tyrants. And that's where we're headed. Anyway, I think there's enough said about that. Let's move on. Anyway, he says, verse 15, and it is clearer still if another priest arises according to the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become such, not on the basis of law or physical requirement, but according to the power of an indestructible life. For it is witness of him, thou art a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. For on the one hand, there is a setting aside of a former commandment, because it is weakness and uselessness. And for the law made nothing perfect. And on the other hand, there is a bringing in of a better hope, through which we draw near to God. And inasmuch as it was not without an oath, for they indeed became priests without an oath, but he with an oath, through whom he has said to him, the Lord has sworn, and it will not change his mind, thou art a priest forever. So much the more also Jesus has become the guarantee of a better covenant, and the former priests on the one hand existed in greater numbers because they were prevented by death from continuing, but he on the other hand, because he abides forever, holds the priesthood permanently. Okay, now it's comparing the two priesthoods, the Melchizedek priesthood, the order of Melchizedek, and the Levi priesthood, or the Aaronic priesthood. He's saying that look at the Aaronic priesthood. We got a situation here where the Levite priests, they had to offer up sacrifices continually, daily. Okay, they had to offer up sacrifices for themselves because they were sinners, right? And then when they offered the sacrifice for themselves in their own household, then they could offer sacrifices for the rest of the nation. Okay, and this was continual for them. They had to do this constantly because men are constantly sinning. So they constantly need a priest to act on their behalf, right? But the one thing, another thing about the Levitical priesthood is that the priest died off. So the priesthood had to be passed on from generation to generation to continue this priesthood and continue the role of the priest as interceding between man and God on man's behalf. But then he makes the contrast with Christ. It says here that he quoted from Psalm 110, where God says, "Thou art a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek," and then he swears by himself that he will be a priest forever, permanently. So when Christ died, in actuality, what happened was when he died and he ascended to heaven, there's a temple in heaven. We are told that. We are told that in Revelation. We are told in other parts of Scripture that actually the temple of Solomon was a pattern of the temple that's in heaven now. Well, when Christ died, went to heaven, he went there as our high priest. He actually went into the Holy of Holies. He didn't bring the blood of goats or bulls or anything else. He brought his own blood into the Holy of Holies, where his father was, sprinkled the blood upon the Ark of the Covenant in the temple in heaven. And he resides there as our priest forever. Okay? Because God has sworn by his own name that Christ will be forever our priest. So there's not a need for a continual, of Christ dying on the cross continually. Okay, what he's done it once and for all. But the blood continues to be applied forever, in the sense that men are in constant need of this forgiveness. You see how the role played out as Christ as our high priest? Because remember, no one could be a priest unless they were from the tribe of Levi, mm-hmm. And you couldn't be a high priest unless you came directly under the line of Aaron. Well, Christ was from the tribe of what?
Judah.
He was not from the tribe of Levi. That disqualified him from being a priest as far as men were concerned. But God ordained him to be a priest centuries before he came down to become a man. Out of a totally different order. out of the order of Melchizedek, not out of the order of Aaron or the order of Levi. So you see the interesting situation that unfolds for us? Mm. We have a high priest, but he does not come from the line of Aaron. Okay? The Jews would not accept Christ as a high priest. He's not a Levite. He's not from the tribe. He's from Judah. Right? But God ordained him from a totally different order, having no beginning and no end. See? This is what he's trying to... The point
that
is...
Are there principal reasons for denying
Messiah? No. That's not... But let's just say today, if we were to say, hey, Jesus Christ is our high priest, and he's the high priest of, you know, let's say Israel. Well, they say, he wasn't even from the tribe. How could he possibly even be a priest? See, they would scoff at that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And rightly so, in a sense. But you see, they fail to see their own scriptures where it says, where God swore by himself, centuries before Levi even came on the scene, you know, that there was a priest, there was a priest by the name of Melchizedek, and then in the book of Psalms, he swore that Christ would be a priest forever under his order. Okay, but the Jews don't reject Christ on that basis because they reject him from square one, so they never even get this far to reject him. But if you argue with them, hey, your high priest is Jesus. Hey, he can't even be a priest because he's just from the tribe of Judah. Well, you know, in a sense, God is that priesthood has been made obsolete through Christ's priesthood. And then he says, verse 23, and former priests, on the other hand, existed in greater numbers because they were prevented by death from continuing. But he, on the other hand, because he abides forever, holds his priesthood permanently. Hence also he abides to save forever those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. Okay, you know, this is the role of Christ that he has today. We are told that, okay, that he is constantly making intercession on our behalf, okay? We are told, too, that the Satan, okay, stands as our accuser before God, constantly accusing us of all these different things, but Christ is our high priest who makes intercession on our behalf instead, right? Then it says, in verse 26, it says, for it was fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens, who does not need daily, like those high priests, to offer us up sacrifices, first for his own sins, then for the sins of the people, because this he did once and for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints men as high priests who are weak, but the word of the oath, which came after the law, appoints a son made perfect forever. See, read that again, that last verse. For the law appoints men as high priests. The law, what law? The Mosaic law, mm-hmm. Okay? Which was introduced under Moses, right? For the law appoints men as high priests who are weak, but the word of the oath, which came after the law, it came when? When was this oath spoken? If it was in Psalm 110, who wrote it?
David.
So it was spoken, okay, centuries after the law was ordained, then through David, okay, the Holy Spirit prophetically uttered this oath that God swears by himself that Christ would be a priest forever according to Melchizedek. That's what it's saying here. But the word of the oath, which came after the law, appoints a son made perfect forever. Anybody have anything you want to add or share?